Good evening, you guys. K2 Romeo India Whiskey is my call letters. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the Technical Met, which meets most Sunday evenings for the last 29 years at 8 o'clock Sunday night, so that ham radio operators can discuss their favorite subject. And at times we go a little bit beyond ham radio, as you guys probably know. K2 KEY Mel, if he's available, will be reading us what mail he's been receiving. I hear tell that we're going to be getting a question tonight from Bob, K4NBC, from Florida, on his super-duper power supply. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. For those who sign in during the first hour, we make a zero attempt during the first hour to answer everyone's question, at least briefly, so therefore you don't have to wait more than an hour to get an answer. Beyond the first hour, Paul, WS2N, tells us what NASA has been doing. He's our space expert. And after that, we discuss almost any subject. And one of the subjects that would be kind of fun to discuss is that experiment that's been going on with CERN, the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland. For a couple of years now, they've been sending neutrinos through the ground, 741 kilometers away, over to Italy, to the Gran Sasso National Laboratory. And the neutrinos have been traveling faster than the speed of light. Not a whole lot faster, but faster. It's really got people upset. And in the last week or so, they duplicated the experiment with higher accuracy and got the same answer. So there's a lot more to the story. We'll someday find out what's really going on. Okay, I'll take in the check-ins at this time. Give me your call letters, name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
Then yes.
Okay, I heard Steve. There was a triple that time. Steve, I should know your call letters by now.
KC2, Mike Delta Papa.
Very fine, Steve. Who was the other person?
N2EO, Rich, and yes. Good evening, Dick.
All right, okay, we got Rich. Was there a third person?
K4NBC, Bob, and yes.
Good thing we waited long enough for Bob. Yeah, we got to wait a little bit longer. Everyone signing in, try to remember to wait for the all four beeps so that the machine can reset. So, alrighty, we got three check-ins so far. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N, Paul, Space Report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. And one last call. Any other check-ins for the TechNet with a question or a comment?
KC2WGB, after Paul.
K2 Monkey's Uncle Bernie, yes.
KCTZ.
Okay, we got WS2N, K2 Monkey's Uncle Bernie, and Hal, are you signing in with a question or a comment? K6TPZ, K2RIW.
I just have a comment that I wanted to mention about the dinosaur being up and working.
Okay, so you've got a comment. All right, the first person with a real question was Steve, KC2, MDP. I think it's MDP. Great, Steve, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yes, Mike Delta Papa. I have a question concerning SWR, basically SWR bridge here that I have. Basically what I'm doing is I was doing some antenna work to my 220 rig, and I have an SWR meter that goes to 160 meg. I have one that does 430, then I have one that does, I think it may be 430 to like 1300. Well, regardless, I figured the one meter here from, for 160 would be close enough to 220. Now, when I hooked this thing up, it was almost like it was backwards. And in other words, I was getting like 5 watts forward and like 20 watts reflective power. Now, I don't even think that's even possible. How can you get more reflective power than forward? Well, anyway, what I did is I tried a couple other meters. I tried the UHF meter. That seemed to work a lot better. I just, for the heck of it, I put the meter I was having a problem with on a dummy load, and the same thing. In other words, I calibrated. Basically, when you go to SWR, the meter would jump off the scale. Curious. Any questions why this would do this? Back to you, Dick.
Yes, I've got a couple of guesses on this one, Steve. What you're looking for in a SWR bridge, what you're looking for in a Berg watt meter, what you're looking for in a directional coupler, is the high directivity. You get the greatest amount of response out of a directional coupler, and in many cases you get the highest directivity when the internal pickup line, in other words, if you really study what's inside of a directional coupler, and if it was made out of strip line, there's a straight-through coaxial cable, coaxial-like structure, and right alongside of it, there's a parallel line that samples some of that signal. And if the parallel pickup line is a quarter of a wavelength long and properly terminated, it picks up an amount of signal that's either 6 dB down, 10 dB down, 20 dB down, depending on the spacing. And if it's got the right dummy load, it'll have high directivity. It'll favor the power going forward and see essentially none of the power going backwards. Now, it would be real nice if you could buy an SWR bridge that ran from 160 meters to 1300 megacycles. For a whole bunch of reasons, you can't do that. If you made it a quarter wavelength long at 1300 megacycles, at 160 meters, the thing would be, you know, like 1% long instead of a quarter of a wavelength long, the pickup line, and it would have extremely poor sensitivity. And unless you did some other compensating, it probably would have poor directivity. The bottom line of all this is that directional couplers, SWR bridges and whatever, tend to have a certain frequency region over which they work well. And rarely is that more than a decade in frequency, a 10 to 1 frequency range, rarely. On top of that, a directional coupler that's made for 160 meters might be made out of diodes that are inexpensive and don't have very good high frequency response. I had one particular directional coupler, a swerve bridge, which did go down to 160 meters. I remember using it on 432, and mine didn't read backwards like yours, but mine had another peculiar characteristic. As I started putting transmitter power through it, the diodes, which were not rated for that frequency range, would heat up, and they would periodically go into a short circuit, so the needle would dance around, even though the power output of my transmitter was steady. So, poor directivity. There's all kinds of ways you can confirm the directivity. You did that with a good dummy load. So, quite possibly that machine has been damaged, doesn't have the right dummy load connected to it. The diodes are not working correctly. There's a whole lot of things that can go wrong. There's very few things that make an SWR bridge work correctly. A lot of things got to be working correctly. Now, how much directivity you're getting out of your SWR bridge is an important parameter. In other words, the average person picks it up, connects it to the antenna, turns on the transmitter, zeroes it in the forward mode, flips to the reverse mode, and says, aha, my standing wave ratio is 1.85 to 1. You could do that if you're kind of naive. A smarter person will periodically check the machine itself by putting it into a known dummy load and the amount of power the dummy load can tolerate and find out what directivity. In other words, with a real good dummy load, you should measure, let me pick a number, 10 watts forward and extremely close to 0 watts going back. And if you want to be double darn sure the machine is working correctly, then unplug your SWR bridge and simply reverse the input and output connector without moving the calibration dial. Just turn it around backwards, but now flip it into the forward or reverse switch position, and it should measure what looks like 10 watts forward, correction, 10 watts reverse in my example, and 0 watts forward. You're now independently checking the diode that's doing the forward measurement, the diode that's doing the back measurement, the directivity of the forward line, and the directivity of the reverse line. A smarter person will go through that calibration procedure at his operating frequency on his particular SWR bridge into a known good dummy load before he believes anything. Let me drop. There's a hell of a lot of guys out there who have a SWR bridge where they have not done that calibration procedure of the SWR bridge itself, if they have a slightly defective forward diode and a real good operating reverse diode, so when you do the cal procedure, they're really doing too much adjustment of the gain control, the calibration control, so that the reading they get is going to be, the reading they're going to get is going to be pessimistic. By the way, when you hear obstructive things going on this particular net, do periodically flip your reverse button and listen to the input and tell us how strong the input signal is when you're hearing disruptive behavior. And then if you could report that to Len, K2IVX, at limarc.org, that'll be very helpful information, particularly what goes on at around 11:30 at night. Again, somebody puts out a weak carrier at that time and tries to be disruptive. For the most part, we don't address the people that are doing disruptive behavior. We ignore them and feel sorry for them that they think this is the right thing to do. It's going to make them happy. It ain't going to make them happy. Let me drop. So do reverse, do flip that reverse switch and measure how much signal strength you hear on the input, and please report it to Len, K2IVX, who's in charge of the interference committee. Okay, so if you didn't do that calibration procedure, and if you got a defective diode or defective isolation on one of those couplers, every good SWR bridge usually has two separate couplers, two separate diodes. All of that has to be properly terminated, properly operating, and the gain control set in order to get a reasonable reading. And so you can easily get a reading that's optimistic, pessimistic, maybe accurate if everything's working just right. And you'd be amazed because of the directivity problem. Many a SWR bridge has marginal directivity. And the bottom line of that is that you think you're measuring a 1.5 VSWR. It might really be a 1.1 VSWR. And those kind of errors in the machine are very phase sensitive when the error is there. If the machine is working correctly, it's not phase sensitive. But when the machine is working poorly, it becomes phase sensitive. And there's a zillion guys you can listen to on 20 meters every day of the week saying, I changed the length of the cable, I added an extra random length of coax to my feed line going to the antenna, and now the SWR is a better number than it was before. You believe that, and I'm going to sell you a bridge in Brooklyn. Real standing wave ratio is a certain amount of power coming back down from the antenna. Just because you've made the feed line, assuming you're adding a random length that's low in loss, just because you've made the feed line a little bit longer or a little bit shorter of the exact same kind of cable, and if the standing wave ratio changes, you haven't changed the magnitude of the reflected power. You've only changed the phase angle by adding an extra cable length in there. And if your SWR reader meter reads differently, and if you believe those readings, you're in a lot of trouble. There's a lot of guys who run into that problem, and they're convinced that there is a magic length of feed line that'll make the standing wave ratio essentially disappear. Absolutely not true. So there's a lot more to SWR than meets the eye. So you've done the first step when you did that dummy load test, Steve. I recommend you do it on each one of your machines and do the double calibration test into the dummy load. In other words, calibrate it in the forward mode so you get full scale, go to the reverse mode, take a reading, then take the SWR bridge and reverse it without changing the calibration pod, and now read forward and reverse, and you should get the exact same amount of reverse and forward power as you had forward and reverse before. Now you're really testing the machine at the frequency that you care about. And just because your SWR bridge works real well at 10 meters doesn't mean it's going to work real well at 2 meters. There's a whole lot of things that can happen when you change frequency. Buyer beware. Tester beware. You see what I'm saying here, Steve. And as you do these further tests, please come back either later on tonight or tomorrow or next week and let us know what you found out. KC2NDP, K2RIW on the TechNet. Radio 404 beeps.
60PZ with a comment.
Okay, we're going to pick up Steve first, and then we'll go over to Hal in that order. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, I'll have to pull some more tests on this. I don't know if I said 160 meters or 160 meg. I meant to say 160 meg, and I figured 160 meg would be close enough to 220 that I'd get, you know, I know I wasn't going to get an accurate reading. I figured, you know, I'd get within the ballpark to make sure that at least the antenna is performing marginally well. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I'll have to pull some tests on this thing. I'll definitely do that, reverse the the antenna and the transmitter thing and see what I get. And I definitely will report back to you. Thank you so much, Dick.
Yeah, if you're smart enough, Steve, you can then do the metrology test. By that I mean, if you have a known good dummy load, and you measure apparent forward and reverse power with the machine set up correctly, then you flip it around backwards and you measure apparent reverse and forward power, and you record all those numbers. You then have enough raw data that when you take the real reading on your antenna, it's not enough information, because you don't have the phase information, not enough information to make the error go away, but you can put error limits on it. In other words, once you make the measurement with a known good dummy load, forward and reverse, you know, in the normal mode and putting it upside down, so to speak, you then, when you measure your real antenna, if, for instance, the apparent standing wave ratio is 1.5 to 1, and because of the metrology measurements you made, you then be able to put an error limit on it, like plus or minus 0.2, so that you know you measured 1.5 to 1 plus or minus 0.2, therefore you could say my real visoir is somewhere between 1.3 and 1.7, even though I just measured 1.5. You could then put in other lengths of cable to your antenna, other lengths of the feed line, and you would see that it would move around within those margins of 1.3 to 1.7. And if that calibration test, forward and reverse, shows everything perfect, then in theory, when you read 1.5, it'll be plus or minus nothing, and you'll know it's really 1.5. K6DPZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Al.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. I just wanted to say, a lot of these radios that have a standing wave system built into them, and they're power sensing when you have standing waves, and power will cut back. If you do add a length of cable, you can match to the radio, so you'll get the power out of the radio without using a matchbox. That was my only comment there.
Yeah, what I think you're saying, in the case of a no-tune radio, by the way, you didn't wait for all four beeps there, Hal. When you have a no-tune radio where you don't have a tuning and loading control in the output, and if the antenna is not perfect, if there really is some reflective power, there is a number of magic lengths of cable where the reflective power has the particular phase angle that the transmitter with no tune will be pleased with it. If you, in the commercial world or in the military world, they call it a pull test. You put a known standing wave ratio and a trombone between the transmitter and the load with the known standing wave ratio, and then you operate the trombone, which means you're changing the phase angle of the power reflected back to the transmitter. Every realistic transmitter, as you operate that trombone, will go slightly higher and slightly lower in power output, and somewhere along that length of that trombone is a place where the power will peak, and as long as your transmitter final stage doesn't draw too much current when you're in that mode of operation, and as long as you've done some other kind of a test to confirm that you still have sideband linearity. You've got to be careful about just peaking the maximum power out of a transmitter. You can do various things on a no-tune transmitter to maximize the power, but in that particular mode where you think you're getting the best possible setting, you might not. It may be a particular load that, yeah, puts out more power before you modulate, but when you do modulate, your third-order intermodulation distortion might be kind of poor, and you might be splattering quite a ways up and down the band, so to speak. So there's more to it than first meets the eye. So I think it was the no-tune transmitter and trying to maximize power output. You got to be careful with that. That's what I think you were addressing, Hal. K6DPZ, for any further comments, wait for all beeps, K2RIW.
Okay. So I was addressing where the transmitter has its built-in SWR sampling circuit, and if it doesn't see near 50 ohms of load, the sampling circuit will cut back the transmitter. That's what I was getting at there.
However, changing the length of cable in that circuit is not going to fix the problem of the power being cut back. Is that what you're saying, Al? Go ahead.
Yeah, it would change. If you have a sampling circuit in the transceiver and it wants to see 50 ohms, and you use a line section that will bring the match to 50 ohms at the transmitter output, it will cut out full power.
Okay. If the line that I'm adding is 50 ohm line And if the line that was there was 50 ohm line up to the antenna, and if the antenna had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, are you telling me that by changing that line length, one, I'm going to hit 50 ohms, and number two, the transmitter will not be cutting back? Are you telling me that by changing the length of the line, when is the visor present, without changing the visor, without changing the impedance of the line, are you saying that's going to adjust the impedance that the transmitter sees in standing wave ratio? Over to you, Hal.
Yeah, because you have a 50 ohm line, you use the same more length of line, you're effectively making a stub. Well, then your stub on the line to bring it back to 50 ohms match. It's not going to be pure. The line may still radiate, but at the other end of the line to go to the transmitter, it'll look like 50 ohms, where the sampler in the transmitter will then put out the power. It's not going to be efficient. The lines are going to radiate, but the transmitter will be happy.
The extra line you're adding, up till now I thought you were adding a series piece of line, but then you use the word stub. Does that mean that the T connector into a parallel piece of line, and now you're adjusting that length of that line? That's a reactance corrector network. So is the word stub, as you use it, a series thing or a T connector thing? How did you mean that, Hal? Go ahead.
It's a series thing. It's not a stub. It's not a T connector. It's a series thing. You add more line until you bring the impedance. That's where it feeds into the radio sampling circuit. It'll look like 50 ohms, and the radio will put out full power, even though the line will be radiating.
Okay. Hal, you and I right now are in very strong disagreement. You've said the exact opposite of what I just said before. You cannot correct standing wave ratio by changing the length of line of the transmission line. I know this is a controversial subject. I know that you and I are going to have a large number of discussions before we settle this. So I'm expressing an opinion, a very strong opinion, that what was just said I disagree with. I know that you feel fairly strongly, and I know that you're in the majority, Hal.
KC2, QIQ with comment?
About half the guys on 20 meters will support what Hal just said. So I'm in the minority here. Now, Glenn maybe is going to correct it. KC2, QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Hal. Good evening, everybody on the net. Let me just let this drop for a second and pick up the four beeps. Maybe not. Okay, Dick, I'm going to go ahead and let me know if I drop out. I believe what Hal is trying to say, and most of us that have transceivers with these auto-tuners experience basically the same thing, where the range of the auto-tuner has a certain amount of finite range. And what's happening is by adding an additional length of cable to the antenna system, what it does is it adds phase length, which basically will push the tuning capability of the tuner into another quadrant, which allows to extend the range of the tuner to pick up those extra points where the tuner would basically not have enough range. By adding more cable, adds more phase length. Back to you, K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Okay, I want you guys to listen on the input by hitting your reverse switch and tell me how strong a signal you're hearing. Yeah, Hal used the word transmitter all three times. Never used the word tuner, automatic tuner. Now I'm in agreement. Yes, every automatic tuner, in the case of a reasonably high standing wave ratio, you could say that on the Smith chart, which represents all possible impedances, there are certain locations on the Smith chart where the automatic tuner might get into a hang-up mode and not give you a proper correction. And in that particular circumstance, and that's what Hal was saying, I'm going to have to agree with him, that changing the length of line gets you out of that controversial section of the Smith chart, and now your automatic tuner, if it's present, will suddenly start working. And the automatic tuner will now present to the transmitter a 50-ohm load. So I never heard Hal use the word tuner. I hadn't heard him use the word transmitter on each one of those times. And I thought Hal was saying that the standing wave ratio of the antenna system plus its feed line will change by only changing the length of the feed line. And that's what I was objecting to. You might want to add a couple of words of all this. Hal, we're putting words in your mouth for you. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KQRW in Texas, KQCBB. Possible, and I want to know, if you take, go on the transmitter, these solid-state radios, they go right into their own built-in directional coupler. And directional coupler wants to be 50 ohms out of that, to have full power on the transmitter going out by control. But if you use different length lines, you can automatically bring it in to the 50-ohm point where the directional coupler will
match
and give you your power output, even though it's a mismatch on the line. It'll be radiated. I got to pull in. I'm just getting the TTH. I'll try and begin a little later to make some comments. Yeah, we go around with this, Dick, because I've seen the situation. I've been able to correct things by using the same line, a longer length. At KQRIW, I got to go QRT now. I'm just pulling in. It's K6DPC. I'll try and get on a little bit.
WV2U with a quick comment.
WV2U, go right ahead.
KJ4ILKR.
I understand what you're saying exactly, that the absolute value of the SWR doesn't change. However, if you do institute a phase angle change and the rig or the automatic tuner is working the same as a poor SWR meter, that would seem to be that, essentially the problem with looking at the feet, whether the is the automatic tuner not matching or the transmitter falling back in power, gets cured, even though the absolute SWR on the feed line does not change. Simply, moving the phase of the reflected signal is enough to make all the equipment happy. This is WV2U, back to that.
WV2U, that's Paul, K2RIW. Many of the sampling circuits that are built into transmitters, they're sort of an amplifier. They were not carefully adjusted to have high directivity. If the sampling circuit was really a directional coupler, as it should be, so that I can independently see forward power going out of the transmitter towards the feed line and reverse power coming back because of standing wave ratio, if there really was a pair of directional couplers working correctly, the fact that they're inside the transmitter or outside the transmitter by way of your SWR bridge or part of your antenna tuner should not matter. And therefore, there is no so-called 50-ohm load point where you change the length of line. If there's no antenna tuner involved, and if your sampling circuit built into your transmitter was not properly adjusted, if it has poor directivity, yes, you will get this condition where changing the length of line will make the circuit give you more power output, won't cut itself back. It shouldn't be doing that. There's a lot more to this. KJ4ILK, I think it is. Please start off with your name, sir, and your comment. Wait for the four beeps. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. Kilo Juliet 4, India Lima Kilo. My name is Ricky in Ringgold, Georgia. And I was wondering, can you take a PL259 connector and turn that into an antenna? Or how does that work? Because I need to set something up in a small area where I can't have big, tall antennas.
Okay, Ricky, I think your question was, can you take a PL259 connector and make that into an antenna? And I presume you're talking about a frequency below 10 gigahertz. At 10 gigahertz, you can almost do that. On any of the 80 through 10 meter frequencies, absolutely not. If you want a reasonable antenna, you've got to invest some real estate. There's got to be some real feet of wire up in the air, if you know what I mean. So if that's the question you were asking, I think the answer is no. But that is a different subject than the one on the table right now. Standing wave ratio, we haven't heard the end of it. We're going to be discussing this for a long time to come. Let me go on to the next person because we've dwelled on this one long enough. The second person who signed in was Rich, N2EO. And how's that high-power circuit of yours coming out there, Rich? You're building lots of rigs that go up to 6 meters. N2EO, Whitestone, K2RIW, TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Jake, everybody. N2EO. Yeah, the 6-meter ramp. Haven't used it a lot because, well, Barry called me the other day, told me 6 meters was open. But he was trying to get hold of me and I wasn't available for the band opening. Would have liked to have been on with the 6-meter kilowatts. So, all right. Jake, have a computer question tonight. It really belongs on the computer net, but maybe somebody here, we have a lot of collective knowledge here. My girlfriend Patty said to me she wants a small photo printer for Christmas. Not interested in printing text. And I've seen them. I just haven't paid attention to it because I've had a need for one before. They're sort of like about, I'm going to reset. They're sort of like the width of a sheet of paper, you know, 8 by 10, 10 inches, 12 inches wide. They're maybe about 4 inches deep, 2 inches high. Very, very small printer. Patty uses a laptop in her apartment. She goes between Whitestone here and her apartment. And she just wants something because she has a point-and-shoot camera that has a USB port. We saw one that said it will take slides, it will take photographs and make copies, but it said nothing about USB ports. Also, what I'm wondering is, with the average digital camera, what I normally do is I'll download from my camera or her camera to a file on the computer, pick out the picture I want, and print it. With a printer like this, could she actually pick out one particular photograph and say, I want to print that off the SIM card? I don't know if anybody can answer the questions, but this is what she wants for Christmas, so I'm trying to get some information. N2EO, back to that.
By the way, I'm hearing an S3 single strength here in Huntington on that particular signal that you just heard. Does anyone have a suggestion for a small photographic type printer? In other words, not just something that'll print alphanumeric. He wants to really make a color picture. I'm going to guess it might be inkjet. So you're really, I think, looking for a small inkjet printer that would be compatible with a laptop. Anybody got a suggestion for a brand name and model number? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, what I should have said, I'm looking for something very, very compact that she can just carry around with her in one hand. I've seen them, never paid much attention to them before.
Yeah, there's another catch there, though, Rich. Do you want it to be battery-operated? Now, that's adding another restriction, because most of these inkjet printers, I think, run on 110 volts. Over to you, Rich. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, it doesn't have to run on a battery. It's just that if she goes somewhere, she wants to be able to put it down on the table, plug in her camera, even if she has to plug the printer in and make a copy of one very small, but very compact. Never paid much attention to them before.
KC2, QIQ.
And as I'm hearing, it's probably got a hell of one that'll do this. KC2, QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, the sky's the limit on these, Dick. There are these color printers that print for photographic quality with the photo paper. As a matter of fact, most of them usually do print by print. Mass printing with photo printers is kind of the oddity, not the single print. Single print is really what they're made for. Usually, when people want to do prints for, like, lots and lots of copies, like 24 exposures or 34 or 100, you go to a company like Snapfish, and you send your file over the Internet to them, and you let them print out all the pictures for you, because it's much less expensive to do it that way. Let me let it drop for a second.
And also suggest a model number and brand name if you happen to know of one.
Well, the model numbers I'm a little skeptical on giving them, mainly because the models are changing every day. I mean, you think they run 6 month cycles, and there's the next one out, and they get better and better every day. And but there are quite a few small ones, but I would suggest Rich's two brand names to follow. I prefer HP myself, as far as their printers go. And I know that if you go to the HP website and you go into, and look for color photo printer and look what comes up, you'll see from the micro miniature to the gigantic. And they do everything. They print directly from SD card, USB, and even wireless now. So you have kind of like everything there. But the really little compact ones, I have one called a 110, an HP 110, and this thing is high by 5 inches wide by 4 inches deep or something like that. And that's already like 6, 7 years old. And but I can still get cartridges for it, and the 4x6 you know, paper, photo paper you can put inside there is very, very readily available. But I would say either HP or Canon, Dick. Those are the two brand names. And just go to the websites and check them out. You can, there's a, quite a variety out there. KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Glenn. Very good information. And I'm guessing this is an inkjet type printer. I'm reasonably sure a color laser printer is not going to be in that compact size for the kind of prices. Make a rough guess, Glenn. The two brand names you just mentioned, Hewlett-Packard and Canon, and for the approximate size that he wants, inkjet printer, today, make a rough guess to the nearest 50%. What do you think the number of dollars for one of those might be? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I suggest probably this time of year the prices are going to be very competitive, and I'd say probably for a little one like that, it's going to be like $100 for a kit. And usually that kit comes with the little printer, the paper, and the cartridge. And usually a little power supply, that, like a wall wart that comes with it. And, you know, they're typically around the $100 range and probably figure like another $15 for shipping. So I would say, Rich, it could be anywhere from $100 to $150 is going to be the price range.
And here's my next question, Glenn. If he's feeling a little bit rich and he wants to add another $50 or $100 to it, roughly what happens to the size, quality, and whatever when he adds the next increment of money if he's not trying to buy the absolute bottom dollar, if you know what I mean? I didn't wait for the beep, but you should. Oh, go ahead, Glenn.
Well, the next size up is going to be like your 8.5 by 11. So in other words, now you get a full-size print. So instead of doing 4x6 and the small sizes, now you can do the larger photo paper size in 8.5 by 11. And now you're in the, maybe the $150 range to maybe $500 range, you know, for that. And then, of course, then there's more options that you can get with that. There's your Wi-Fi options, all the other things. And then you can also start adding on things like fax machine, copier, all kinds of other good things. When you go to the website, you can see all that on there. And then, of course, then once you hit that, like, $800 range and above, now you're into the color lasers, which are really, really beautiful. If you want to do a lot of color work today, color lasers the way to go.
KC2, QIQ. KC2, WGB, with a comment?
Go right ahead, John.
Dick, I suggest that he watches the Home Shopping Network, HSN. They're on all the time. And Kodak makes a beautiful little one, very portable. Has a little viewing screen. You can select individual photographs. Just press a button and it prints. So you may want to watch a few of those demonstrations on TV. And then, like Glenn says, you know, check on the web and pick out something you like. But they're always on.
Oh, KC2QIQ with a comment about the Kodak?
You got it, Glenn.
I would still go back to either HP or Canon, mainly because those two manufacturers, as far as the photo printing, the only real downside to those two manufacturers are they're expensive if you're going to try to do a lot of copies. If you try to do a lot of copies, you go to an outside company like Snapfish. But if you want to do your onesie twosies, you know, here and there, getting a little print here, a little print there on the little portable, HP Canon is the way to go. The Kodak and some of these other ones that are out there, they're really garbage. I have one here from the little HP. This little thing has got to be at least, I know it's way more than 5 years old. I can still get replacement cartridges for it, and the paper is all standard, and everything works good. The little Kodak ones and some of these other ones that are out there, I think that they may break very quickly, and it's hard to get the cartridges for them and a lot of other things. So I would still stick to the other two brands. But then again, keep in mind, that's just my opinion. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
We welcome all the opinions. And Now, Richie can gather a whole lot of information and make his decision, or at least start making the decision. By the way, for the guy you just heard, John, before, KC2WGB, if you go to QRZ.com and go to KC2 Whiskey Golf, WGB, Whiskey Golf Bravo, you'll see some beautiful pictures of his laboratory. He's got a lot of good test equipment and a very pretty-looking laboratory. I'm going to have to drop into his QTH one of these days and see that. He just recently put up those pictures. So let's see if Rich has any further questions on that particular subject. N2EO, good luck with that one, Rich, and let us know what you decide. K2RAW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, thank you very much. I have waited for the full 4 beeps, women. Hi, all right, now we got it. What I wanted to ask Glenn, if it's okay, yeah, Dick, take another moment. What you want to do is print out, like you say, 1Z, 2Z photographs, but if they're on our point-and-shoot camera, which has what you call a CF card or SD card, whatever it has in it, and she plugs the USB cable from the camera into this little printer, is there some way for her to select which photograph? Well, in other words, would print the photograph that is currently on the LCD display? The reason I'm asking is because the way I normally do it with my Nikon is I download everything on the SD card, then make a file and go through it and pick out what I want printed. But I'm using a computer between the camera and the printer. This way she just wants to plug the camera into the printer. Is there a way to pick which photograph to print, one or two copies of just one? Back to that, N2EO.
You got it, Glenn.
Rich, I don't think so. And the reason I'm saying this is because when you connect a computer with a USB connection to a camera, there's usually some overhead software that comes with that camera that you install on your computer, so that when you plug that specific camera into your USB port, the USB port by itself is dumb, unless it has a driver that explains what's on the other side of that USB port, so it knows what device and which hardware to install. The printer doesn't have the intelligence of the computer and or a place to install software to install a USB driver to determine what kind of hardware is on the other side. So what they do, basically what the printers are, you either have your USB printer to PC wireless, which would be the same as the Wi-Fi wireless connection, or the third one is, like you said, you just take the SD card or whatever memory card is inside the camera, slide it directly into the printer, and make your prints directly from the SD card. But to actually try to use the computer USB interface that you would normally plug into a computer to plug directly into a printer is highly unlikely, because the printer won't have the driver information to know what kind of camera is connected to it. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
K2UX.
Let me run this one by again, Glenn. I think you're saying that as long as the camera is with the proper software connected to a laptop or tower, desktop, a computer, now you can select. But whenever you have a direct connection between camera and printer, or between card and printer, I think you're saying you no longer have a selection capability. In other words, the camera directly to the printer, you cannot select which picture it's going to print. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Wow, I feel like I'm speaking a foreign language. That really isn't what I'm trying to say at all. If you were to take the SD card directly out of your camera and put it into a lot of these printers, the SD card or the memory card will read directly into the printer, and you can select any one photo that you would like to print. No problem at all. What I was talking about is USB. If the camera has a USB connection that's supposed to go to a computer, the USB connection to the camera is a hardware connection. And the printer, okay, when you take the camera and you plug the USB interface from the camera to the computer, you need a software driver to tell your computer that on the other end of that USB cable is a camera. because now the memory is not going directly into the computer. It's the memory is going through the camera, and the camera is creating a communication protocol with the computer to transfer the data. And then, of course, you could select it once the interface is made. Let me let it drop for a second.
Yeah, there's one thing you said that's having given me a problem. If I took the, if I've got 15 pictures on my SD card, and I plug the SD card directly into the printer, how do I select print number 7 and reject all the others? Over to you, Glenn.
WB2U with another comment.
It's actually very easy, Dick. When you plug the, once you plug in your SD card or whatever memory device into you that has just photos on it, and usually the photos are in the JPEG type of arrangement, and you plug them into your printer, the printer has a certain amount of processing capability to read JPEG files. So if it sees direct JPEG files on there, it will read them into memory, and then will display them usually on a very, very small display device that's like a, usually like a 1-inch by 1-inch screen on the printer, and you can scroll through the photos, and then when you hit OK to select that photo, the printer will print it. It's that simple. So as long as you have a direct memory device that has JPEG files on it, it will print directly to the printer. No problem at all. The problem with the USB cable from a camera is that there's no JPEG files on the other end of the USB cable. There's a camera hardware on the other end of the cable. And it, first of all, the computer would have to recognize the camera with a driver device in a computer before it could get through the camera to those JPEG files on the memory card inside the camera. I hope that makes more sense, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment? Yes, it does, Glenn. I know that Paul wanted to make a comment, at least two or three other people. WV2U, go ahead with your comment, Paul.
Okay, well, there is a standard for USB, a mass storage standard, that does not need a custom driver software. So if that camera respects the mass storage USB standard, okay, there's no need for driver software. But that could be only proven by taking the camera to a computer that has not, it's never been installed on, and plugging it in with a USB cable, and seeing if you can see it as a different disk drive, you know, in the My Computer icon. But that's the easy way to tell if it's got the, USB mass storage configuration built into the camera. K2RI, WWB2U, back to that.
K2EO, Dick, I think he's right, because I was able to take that camera, put it on my Apple, and it just hit the ground running.
Oh, wait, did you just say something, Glenn?
Yes. There's a little device that's a USB device called, but it's a memory storage device. Sometimes the people call them thumb drives. There's a lot of different nicknames out there for these little USB drives. They're memory sticks, a memory stick just like the SD card that's inside a camera. And what you can do is you can put JPEG files directly on these little thumb drives or little memory sticks, and slide that USB memory stick into a computer. The computer will recognize the memory stick, and you can print from that. And there are some printers that have this USB interface and will read it. That's not what I'm talking about when I'm saying the USB connection from a camera. Most cameras that have a USB cable that come off of the camera directly are not JPEG files on the other side of that USB. There's hardware from the camera. Now, yes, certain computers and certain software operating systems have drivers built into them so that they will recognize certain types of hardware, including cameras. But if you're expecting a printer to have all of the drivers for all the different cameras and their USB interfaces, I would highly doubt it. That's basically what I'm saying there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Correct. Okay, I think the person who said that comment is now agreeing. Is that true, Mr. Comment?
This is KO2OK. I am one of the people that said comments.
KO2OK, start over with your name and your comment, sir.
Hi, Dick. This is Bennett, KO2OK in New Jersey. The standard that allows you to connect camera directly at printer is called PictBridge, P-I-C-T-B-R, somewhere, Wikipedia or whatever, but it's using USB, and in that case, if you you can just plug them together and work fine. And I think the missing piece before, I think Glenn already pointed out, was there's a screen on a lot of printers now. So you can just plug in a SD or other type of memory card directly into the printer and print out. I would suggest that Rich goes to PCM.com, which is PC Magazine, and they do monthly or...
You stop. Dot com, PCM Magazine. Was there anything else you wanted to say beyond that point? Back to you, Bennett. Okay. Maybe somebody pressed the button on and the frequency switched. Is there anyone else that wants to make comment on this particular subject for Rich about his camera interface to a printer? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KA2PUX, Charles.
Very fine, Charles. It sounded like Kilo Alpha 2 Papa Uniform X-Ray. If I got you correct, go right ahead, Charles.
Hi, good evening. We were talking about this earlier, and I couldn't remember the name of the printer from what he just described. I believe the Polaroid mini printer is what he's looking for. It fits basically into his shirt pocket, and it'll go from the camera right to the printer, and you can print out pictures, and it uses the viewer on the camera to show you which picture you're going to print out.
Okay, Charlie. That's a good piece of information. So looks like you want to look at the Polaroid Corporation also when you do a web search for these particular kind of printers. What if you've got any further questions on this one, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW.
Comment?
All right, Dick, there's another comment. I'll let you pick it up. But I want to thank everybody. I made some notes here. HP 110, Canon, PCM.com, PicBridge Protocol, Polaroid mini printer. I'm going to check all this out. Thank you very, very much. N2EO.
Who's the person who said comment?
N2PPV.
Sounds like November 2, Papa Victor. Please tell me your name and then with your comment.
Steve.
Okay, Steve, go right ahead with your comment. Wait for all four beeps, please.
Another good, good printer, the multifunction Brother printer is very, very good. I own one and very satisfied with it.
Okay, that's another brand name you're going to want to look at, Rich. Brother. Okay, you got lots of brand names. Looks like you're going to have a lot of choices. Let us know how you decide. The next person who signed in was Bob, K4 November Bravo Charlie, way down there in Florida. And we had a 62-degree day today. I wonder what kind of a day you had down there, Bob. K4 November Bravo Charlie, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, Dick, everybody, good evening from the borough of Florida. K4NBC here. The problem that I'm having is I picked up this power supply and solid state amp at a ham fest. A company I never heard of. It's Dancom, Danish made. All American components in it, though, as far as semiconductors, caps, resistors, all that stuff. Allen Brad with the power switch. Guy told me that it was working. The guy was using it for a base station for his ship in his house, and that's all he knows about it. No manual, no nothing, no schematic. The company's out of business. I even hooked up with Marine Radio Service organizations in Denmark and in the UK, and nobody seems to have a manual for this thing laying around. Found another ham. Let me drop it. Found another local ham here who had one of these things. He gave up on it, but he told me ain't going to work because it's a 50 cycle supply and we're on 60 hertz. So the thing is, I've got raw DC voltage coming out of it, the regulator. The circuitry isn't working. Instead of sub-mounted diodes, they're using mostly thyristors in here. There's a lot of op-amps on the circuit board. And I'm thinking that this thing is referencing itself to a 50-cycle sine wave, and maybe I can't get regulated. I have unregulated DC, but I can't get regulated out of it. And I'm suspecting it's because these op-amps that are frequency compensated and 741s and the inverted inputs are being used. I think this is referenced. The supply is firing, regulating off of 50 hertz, and the circuitry won't work with 60 hertz. Or is it a magnetics problem with the transformer? But again, I have unregulated raw 30 volts coming on a 24, but no 24 volt regulated coming out of it. K2RIW, net control, back to you from K4NBC in the borough of Florida, where it's currently 73 degrees.
You're making us a little bit jealous there with that weather. Yeah, I read the email that you sent me on this one briefly. In the case of 741 op-amps, I used them way back in the early 70s. Beautiful op-amp. Half a volt per microsecond is its slew rate, but half a volt per microsecond, and when you're talking about 50 hertz versus 60 hertz, no problem. A 741 op-amp has got extremely good sine wave reproduction capability to at least 10 or 20 kilohertz. So the fact that you're running on 50 hertz or 60 hertz, the op-amp, that's not a factor. In the case of the iron of the transformer, a transformer that's got enough iron to operate at 50 hertz, and you go a few percent higher in frequency, 60 hertz, I can't see the transformer doing anything nasty, with one slight exception. If the transformer is used as some kind of a constant voltage regulating network, there's a kind of way of resonating the iron of a transformer. Then, yes, 50 hertz versus 60 hertz would make a huge difference. You can tell. When you've got one of these transformers that's got a built-in resonating circuit in order to regulate, in other words, there's a kind of transformer you can buy where it doesn't matter where you put in anywhere from 90 to 140 volts, it'll keep putting out a sine wave, or very nearly a sine wave, or 120. It does it by a kind of ferro-resonance. Let me drop. And that kind of a transformer, when it's operating, usually puts out a pretty strong 50 or 60 cycle hum. It's got a great big oil-filled electrolytic capacitor as part of the resonating network on the primary. You can tell that it's a very special transformer with a whole lot of extra leads. If your transformer has just got a normal primary and secondary windings and it's made for 50 hertz, it's got to work on 60 hertz. Now, in your particular case, so the 741s are not a cause. If the transformer is not one of these resonating transformers, that's not a cause. But the fact that you've got these thyristors, now thyristors are the circuits that run on those. They're very efficient rectifiers, and you can time the switching of those rectifiers, and now the timing circuit that tries to fire at a particular phase angle. Yes, that circuit, which is probably using the op-amps, the circuit itself and the way it does its phase angle adjustment, that would be 50 hertz versus 60 hertz sensitive. So the thyristor network is the thing that could be giving you the grief, assuming the thing is in operational order, in my opinion. So that thyristor network and the way it does its phase firing, you're going to have to trace out that circuit, come up with a schematic diagram, and try to analyze it. That's what I think you're going to have to do on this one, Bob. I know that you're looking for 24 volts at a zillion amperes because I believe this is a 1,000-watt solid-state amplifier. You're going to have to make a difficult decision, and that is, do you spend the time dissecting this one, finding out where the phase firing network, how it's operating on those thyristors, by a 24-volt, 100-ampere power supply, if you know what I mean. You've got those kind of choices. And maybe just going out and buying a 24-volt, high-ampere power supply is the easiest way. If I had your money, and that helicopter sitting in the backyard, that's probably what I would do, Bob. I would spend another half hour to see if I can analyze it, and if not, I'd just go out and buy a high current power supply. But drag your feet a little bit in case somebody has a suggestion, although I think you've got a